Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 141, More Kitchen Questions. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking and getting in the kitchen, having more fun, learning new things, all that kind of stuff. Well, it's been kind of a crazy month. It's we're in the second half of August 2019 now. Just got back from a family vacation, so I've been a little out of pocket for about the last week or so. And in the last month, I've changed day jobs. So it's been kind of crazy. So I apologize. I haven't been on as much as I would like to. But, you know, life is full. That's how these things go. But anyway, I'm back today. And I've been gathering up, as I've been out, some questions that have come in on email. And actually, I got a few on Facebook the other day on the Facebook group as well. So I thought I would take some time and maybe knock out a few questions. So many little topics today in the episode. Some of the questions and some of the emails I've gotten were a little more in-depth than they probably deserve a more thoughtful and longer response and conversation. So some of these questions I did receive, I'm not going to be talking about today, but rest assured, I will have some episodes coming up where I will address some questions. So if you sent me one and you don't hear it today, that's probably why. Also, quick housekeeping, of course, kitchencounterpodcast.com is the website. Show notes, which will probably be very limited for this particular episode, will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/141. I got several questions, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on every one, and I probably won't go into a deep dive in the show notes, but I think we've got some good ones. We'll have some fun here. Also, the Facebook group over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/group will take you over to the Facebook group where you can ask to join. It's a closed group, so we don't get a lot of spam and a lot of crazy off-topic stuff in there at all. So you can ask to join the group and hop in there. You can also find me over on Twitter. My username is at TKCPodcast. And of course, you can always send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. All right, then, let's get into some questions. All right, I'm not taking these in any particular order, but I'm just going to start dipping into the grab bag, so to speak. All right, this one came in on email. This is from Tanya, and Tanya had a few things in here, but her main question was this. Hi, Roger, I have a question regarding shrimp. I'm a new home cook, and shrimp is one of my favorite things to eat, but I'm a little intimidated to try to cook it. Actually, trying to cook any seafood is intimidating to me for that matter. Any tips for a newbie when it comes to cooking shrimp? I appreciate any advice you can offer. Thanks, Tanya. Seafood is intimidating for home cooks. I've tackled it in a couple of episodes. I'll put links in the show notes for my fish episodes. Shrimp, though, shouldn't be intimidating at all. It's very easy to handle and to cook. And especially if you're a new cook, Tanya, if you don't have a lot of confidence handling fresh seafood, I would try to get shrimp that is already peeled and deveined, and that will make life a lot easier for you. You don't have to deal with that in the kitchen. You certainly could. There's nothing saying you can't do that. It just saves a couple of steps. And I think at the beginning, if you're just trying to cook shrimp, that'll make your entry a lot easier and a lot less intimidating. And by the way, with any seafood, if you ever have questions when you're buying it, if you have questions about where it's from, how it's sourced, is it sustainable or not, I've mentioned it before, but the Monterey Bay Seafood Watch website and app, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, that is, their website and app, Seafood Watch, it's fantastic. It has information on all sorts of seafood sources. They'll tell you what to buy, what to avoid, primarily for environmental and, you know, overfishing, fish population issues, sorts of things. Not so much from the health perspective, I've noticed, but more from the environmental. But it'll give you an idea of what to avoid and what to go after, and they have quite an extensive shrimp section in there. Anyway, when it comes to cooking shrimp, you know, when you get fresh shrimp, it's going to have that kind of gray, almost a translucent look to it. When you cook shrimp, it really only takes a couple of minutes on heat to cook your shrimp. And when you see shrimp that's kind of turned that pinkish, whitish color, that means it's cooked. when you put raw fresh shrimp into a skillet, for example, with a little oil on, let's say, medium high heat, you're probably only looking at 2 or 3 minutes before that shrimp is ready to go. And with shrimp, it's all about the visual. You just got to watch it. You can't walk away. You have to keep your eye on it when you're cooking it. Because again, when it turns that pinkish white and it becomes opaque and you don't have any of that gray translucent color left, your shrimp is done. If you let it go too much farther than that, it's not going to, you know, be unhealthy to eat or anything, but it will dry out. It will get kind of chewy and rubbery. And I know a lot of people really are off, are put off by that dry, squeaky, rubbery texture of shrimp. So if you want to avoid that, don't overcook the shrimp. That's really the main concern. That's especially if you're cooking shrimp on its own, you know, to add to, say, a salad or to, you know, toss on to some pasta or something. If you're cooking shrimp in a dish, let's say you're making jambalaya or something like that, you don't have to worry about it quite as much because the shrimp will cook into the rest of the dish and overcooking it is not as much of a concern. But yeah, get your shrimp on some high heat with a little bit of fat, oil, whatever, and just keep an eye on it. And in a few minutes, you should be rocking and rolling with some beautiful freshly cooked shrimp. Hopefully that helps. I don't want to overcomplicate it. It's really that simple. And you know what? When you go to cook shrimp for the first time, if you have a whole batch of shrimp, just cook a 2 or 3 at a time right at the beginning until you get the hang of it. No use throwing a whole batch in the skillet and overcooking a whole thing if you're not comfortable with it. So just start out with a few shrimp until you get the hang of it. You know, kind of like that first pancake is always the bad pancake sort of a thing in the kitchen. So jump into the shrimp and let me know how it turns out. Okay, next question. Okay, well, this one came in on the Facebook group, and this one is from Laura. And Laura said, she said, I didn't have to fit this into the episode, but I'm going to anyway. She said, last night I was trying to reheat some frozen spaghetti noodles for my daughter. I slowly brought the frozen noodles up to a boil in a pot, but it lost its starchiness and saltiness. What's a good way to reheat it without losing its flavor or texture? Good question, Laura. So reheating pasta can be tricky because you're right. Just the act of cooking spaghetti noodles, for example, takes a lot of the starch right out of the noodle, right? It goes into the pasta cooking water. And then the act of freezing it and then putting it back into water and basically cooking it a second time, I mean, there's probably not much starch there at all anymore. So what I would really recommend as far as reheating spaghetti, there's a couple of things. If you know you're going to be freezing the spaghetti noodles ahead of time, and it's not just sort of an after the fact, oh, let's freeze the rest of these spaghetti noodles, always try to cook your noodles a little under. So make them a little more firm, a little more al dente than maybe you would ordinarily have them. They should still be edible. You could still eat them, but just a little bit more bite to them. Because any pasta that you cook and let sit, this is whether you're putting it in a casserole or you're in the fridge overnight or whether you're freezing it, it will continue to absorb water and it will continue to soften up a little bit. So if you cook the pasta to already past al dente and a little bit soft and squishy, it's going to be really soft and squishy and maybe even mushy when you go to reheat it the next day or after you pull it out of the freezer. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. Always go for a little bit more on the firm side. And then as far as reheating it, I would say skip boiling it. I would not re-submerge it in water to bring it back up to heat to prepare it for serving. What I would do actually is probably put a serving or however many servings of spaghetti noodles you want into a skillet with whatever sauce it is you're going to be serving it with and actually heating it up together and toss it as you cook it. I think you're going to end up with a lot better results that way. And although it might not be as perfect as the first day you made that spaghetti, it's going to be pretty good if you reheat it up in the sauce that you're going to be serving it with. And by the way, that pasta water that you originally cooked the spaghetti in, that has a lot of starch in it. And if you don't want to waste that, you could always do something like freezing that in ice cube trays. And then you have nice little ice cube serving size starchy water that you can toss one of those in with your spaghetti and sauce and kind of put some of the starchiness back in the dish after you've taken it out of the freezer and you're reheating it. So hopefully, Laura, that helps your frozen spaghetti reheating woes. Okay, moving right along. Let's do another one from the Facebook group here. This is a big topic, but I'm going to say a few things about it. Catherine wanted to know how to best freeze leftovers. Kind of a related idea to the frozen spaghetti. Let me just say a few general things about freezing. And Catherine, you might already know this, but for the benefit of everybody else, and obviously this depends on what type of food you're trying to freeze. But, you know, anything you put in the freezer, your big enemy is air. Whatever you put in the freezer either needs to be put in an airtight container, like those reusable freezer containers that you can screw the cap on or snap the cap on or whatever are good. Freezer bags, like Ziploc freezer bags, where you can get as much of the air out before you freeze something. And if you're going that route and you're freezing solid things like cuts of meat, for example, I would not hesitate to double wrap that. So put maybe a layer of freezer paper around it, and then maybe around that a layer of saran wrap, and then maybe toss that into a Ziploc freezer bag before you freeze it. Because when you have air coming into contact with the food you're freezing, it probably means that air can get out of the container that it's frozen in, and that is a sure way to cause freezer burn, which basically what freezer burn is when whatever it is you've frozen loses moisture. And it's especially prevalent in meats and things like that. And it oxidizes, basically. So there's a chemical change in the food, and it dries out. It changes color. It changes the quality of the food. It's still safe to eat. Freezer burnt food is not unsafe to consume. You won't get poisoned by it or anything. But the texture is going to be off, and it might have a little bit of a dry flavor. So you want to avoid freezer burn if you can. Also, I think when you're freezing leftovers, you should freeze them in small batches, like single serving sizes. Even if you're going to plan to use those frozen leftovers to feed like three or four people, then you just take your three or four servings out and heat them up. What it helps with, I find, is that it's easier to eat your leftovers if they're in single portions. So if you freeze, let's just use the spaghetti example again. If you freeze a gigantic bucket of spaghetti noodles and you go to the freezer by yourself the next day and you go like, oh, I'm going to have some of that spaghetti. Good luck. Like, what are you going to do? Chisel off one single serving of spaghetti noodles from that frozen block of noodles in the freezer? No, you can't do that. And you don't want to thaw it all to get a little bit off and then refreeze it. So freezing in individual portions is great. And you're going to find conflicting information about this next point on the internet. Some folks will say, like, oh, you got to wait for things to cool down completely before you put it in the freezer. I would recommend against that, just for the same reason I would tell you that if you're going to put leftovers in the fridge, you just put them in as soon as you can. You don't let them come to room temperature, right? Because that is a food safety issue. The longer you leave food out between that 40 and 140 Fahrenheit range, which is like pretty much everyone's house temperature falls into that range, right? As your food cools, the longer there's an opportunity for bacteria to start to grow in your food. So just stick it in the freezer as soon as you can. Now, don't, you know, stick a container of boiling soup in the freezer. Use a little bit of common sense. Make sure it's not hot, scorching hot, and it's going to melt anything right next to it. But you certainly don't have to wait for food to become completely room temperature or cooled down before you package it up and put it in the freezer. And also, Catherine, I just want to say good on you for eating leftovers. I've said before on the show, I'm so bad at leftovers. I like leftovers, but for whatever reason, there's like a mental, like a broken mental synapse in my head that just doesn't predispose me to want to eat my leftovers. But anyway, all right, let's see, what do we have next? Oh, here's an email that came from Marietta. Hi, Roger. What is your favorite use for fresh tomato? I was a little overzealous in planting tomatoes this year, and now I have a bumper crop with no end in sight. Aside from giving several away to my neighbors, I'm wondering if you have ideas or suggestions for your favorite ways to use fresh tomatoes. I'll often use them for pico de gallo and salsa, and my husband and I love to eat them raw with a little bit of salt. What else should I do with all of these tomatoes? Good question. I even put a vague poll in the Facebook group the other day that said who prefers their tomatoes raw and who prefers their tomatoes cooked. And the overwhelming majority of you, I was totally shocked to learn, prefer your tomatoes raw. I, for one, am not a real big raw tomato guy. They have their place. You know, a little raw tomato on a salad is fine. And of course, they're indispensable in BLTs. So, Marietta, if I were you, I'd be eating a lot of bacon, lettuce, tomato sandwiches. Use up some tomatoes that way. But for me, what if I have an abundance of tomatoes and pico de gallo and salsa, great ways to use up tomatoes. I personally would probably make a ton of tomato sauce and either freeze it or can it. But tomato sauce is something that every home cook worth their salt should know how to make. And it freezes and it keeps very well. And it can be used in tons and tons of different applications. So you can turn it into pizza sauce. You can turn it into pasta sauce. You can use it as a base for some tomato soup, even if you prepare it in a very basic way before you can it or freeze it. So that's one way to do it. You could make tomato-centered dishes like shakshuka, which is basically a skillet full of crushed tomatoes or tomato sauce, basically with some spices in which you poach eggs. That's fantastic. You can make a tomato pie. I know we have some Facebook group members that make those. And if you popped in there and asked about it, they'd probably be happy to share recipes and tips. You could, of course, sun dry or dehydrate your tomatoes, and preserve them that way. There's a lot of things you can do with tomatoes. So my favorite thing though is tomato sauce. And salsa. So I would make that until the cows came home if I were you. But yeah, hopefully that gives you a couple of ideas. Oh, she has a second part to her email. Also, my husband and I seem to always have an ongoing discussion about whether tomatoes should be seeded before using them in recipes like salsa. Is it always a good idea to seed them before using in a recipe? And if so, why? That's a very good question, Marietta. And honestly, I think what it all comes down to, at least in my opinion, is do you want seeds to be in the food that you're going to eat? Because I'll tell you, it's not really going to change the flavor, but it will change possibly the texture a little bit, depending on how seedy it is and what the concentration of seeds is. But, you know, if you're making tomato sauce, there's no reason you have to remove all the seeds from your tomatoes. If you really want to, because you don't want the seeds in your sauce, you know, you can cut your tomatoes in half, kind of around the equator, use your fingers or a spoon to dig the seeds out. But here's the thing, you know, that, kind of jelly type, viscous liquid that's kind of around the seeds in the tomato, that's really flavorful stuff. And it would be a shame to lose that. So you might want to press, your seeds with that gel around them through a fine mesh strainer to capture the seeds, but let the gel go through, and then you can return the gel back to your tomato recipe. There's a lot of flavor and yumminess in that that you would certainly not want to miss out on. But, you know, honestly, if you're cutting up pico de gallo, if you're making salsa, if you're making a shakshuka, I don't think seeds are that big of a deal. And you know what? If you're making a lot of it, all of a sudden seeding all those tomatoes, that's a lot of work. So I wouldn't sweat it. It's not that big of a deal to take the seeds out of your tomatoes. It's really personal preference. Okay. All right, Marietta, thank you for that question. It was excellent and very seasonal, I might add. Okay, let's see. We've got some more Facebook questions. This one is from Nancy, and she asks, what is the best way to dry hot peppers like banana, habanero, Thai, jalapeno, and cayenne peppers? Well, Nancy, you didn't mention it here, but I'm guessing you also must have a bumper crop of produce that on your hands, like a lot of hot peppers, which I think is awesome, which maybe makes me think you live in a climate that's pretty warm and arid, perhaps. I could be making all this up, so that if that's not true, I apologize. But I bring that up because if you do live in a dry, arid climate, one of the best ways you can dry peppers is air drying them. Just, you know, really just putting them out in a warm, dry spot, you know, protected from critters like birds and things like that, because they will eat your peppers. But putting them out where the sun and the heat can dry them naturally, and in a couple of weeks you have a beautiful batch of dried peppers. And you might be familiar with this, but they're called ristras, and there it's R-I-S-T-R-A-S. And those are those sort of decorative looking strings of peppers you always see in images or in real life, like in Santa Fe, you know, in the doorways, they're hanging their dried peppers. Beautiful, decorative, but also very functional, and also, you know, a really great way to dry peppers. Now, barring that, probably the easiest and most efficient way to dry peppers, or any produce for that matter, is to use a food dehydrator. So if you have access to one of those, you know, you can knock out a lot of dried peppers with, you know, pretty good results, pretty consistent results, and it's not going to take you a couple of weeks to take care of those. So I guess my answer to that would be, preference one would be to use a food dehydrator. And all your peppers sound fairly small in size, so you could dry them whole. If you have large peppers, or if your habaneros are pretty big, or your banana peppers are fairly big, I guess, you could always cut those in half to make them dry a little more evenly and quickly. But yeah, a food dehydrator, natural air drying, and if neither of those are an option, you could always do something in the oven at your lowest oven setting, you know, laid out in a single layer on a baking sheet or a wire rack with a baking sheet underneath. And you could, you know, I think my oven goes down, I'm not sure what my oven goes down to. Is it 165, or does it go lower? You want to get down to like 120, 130 if your oven goes that low. You could try that method. All right, good luck with the pepper drying, Nancy. Okay, here's another Facebook one. Ruby says, so I work at this cafe as a second job that had a kitchen that is basically like the size of a large home kitchen. There are no fryers. This week, we're also opening up a small rustic pub, and we're trying to come up with a pub menu with snacks and appetizers on top of what we already have. Any ideas? What a fun question. Menu planning for a little eating establishment. How fun is that? I was trying to think about this. So if you have no fryers, which of course fryers are stalwart tools in, you know, the appetizer business, and you don't have a lot of room to cook, I mean, you're certainly probably going to want to focus on items so you don't have to do a lot of short order cooking. So you can do a lot of prep ahead and then serving. And unfortunately, with no fryers, one of the things I think is an awesome kind of pub idea, and I'm thinking like English pub, I guess, but Scotch eggs would be awesome. I like my Scotch eggs deep fried because it just makes a great texture. But, you know, you could make Scotch eggs in an oven as well. And a Scotch egg, if you're not familiar, is a hard boiled egg inside a ball of sausage, essentially, and cooked. So Scotch eggs would be kind of cool. There was this English pub in Ashland, Oregon. Well, there still is this English pub called the Black Sheep. And I don't think they have it anymore, but they used to have this appetizer. Man, I loved it so much. It was, this is going to sound weird probably, but stick with me. It was a smoked sea trout pate. So think, I guess you could say like more like a smoked salmon type of a flavor, if you will, but it was trout, steelhead, I guess. And it came sort of in a little log with some crackers. Oh my gosh, it was so amazing. And you couldn't find it just anywhere. So something like that, where you could make several batches of it ahead of time and just portion it out to serve it, would be kind of neat. Also something very simple, like a pub lunch or a pub tray. And I've seen these where it's just a little tray of food and maybe you have a hard boiled egg and a couple of wedges of some sharp cheese, some pickled vegetables, you know, a hunk of chewy, crusty bread with some gourmet mustard, or honey served with it. And maybe some nuts. That could be kind of a fun little, platter to serve as an appetizer. Or another thing that I think is really simple to execute and is very adaptable, and you could do a lot of different things with, are like crostinis. So maybe like a nice 9-grain or whole grain slice of bread that you can toast under the salamander or in the oven or whatever, under the broiler, and then topped with you know, whatever you want, some beef and caramelized onions and blue cheese, or, you know, tomatoes, mozzarella and basil. You can make like a little caprese, crostini. So there were just a few things that, that came to mind. If I think of anything else, I'll definitely mention it in the Facebook comments, because I, you know, you can always do the basic, like somebody mentioned, I think cheese and fruit plates and things like that. So there's a variety of things you can do, but I think to me, the key would be you can make large batches of whatever it is that just get portioned out when it comes time to, you know, serve the guests when they order your appetizers. Let's see here. I didn't clarify if it's a full menu or just sort of a pub grub, bar food type thing, but, that sounds like you've got some exciting times ahead of you, Ruby. So good luck with the new, rustic pub opening. All right, I've got a few more questions here, but as I mentioned earlier, they're kind of bigger topics, so I think I'm going to save these for an upcoming show. But just to give you an idea of what we're going to be talking about, I've got some dishes every home cook should master. That's going to be a topic for an upcoming show. I'm going to talk a little bit about more live cooking episodes, and I want to revisit a topic that a listener sent me an email about, which is meal kits and all-in-one appliances and things like that. So we are going to have some deeper conversations. So there was another topic I really want to get into about cooking for comfort, and we'll talk about that in more detail in a future show. So until then, I think I'm going to leave the questions where they are for now. I've got another episode coming up real soon, kind of a bonus episode, if you will, that I'm going to get out right away on pudgy pies. So stay tuned for that one as well. Well, that is going to do it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. If you like what you hear and you want to get a hold of me, remember you can always send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com or find us on Facebook at kitchencounterpodcast.com/group. All right, everybody. Once again, this is Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. And until next time, happy cooking.